The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
Many will refer to Myanmar conflict or the opposition as the rebels or rebellions, but it has gone beyond a rebellion. I think that using that word doesn't properly describe what's happening. It's a revolutionary war. Yes. So rebellion is just changing, a limited change. For example, regime change, that would be a rebellion. But this is a systematic change that people are trying to do, and that is more of a revolution, a new system.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. In February 2021, Myanmar's military overturned a national election and seized power. What began as a political crisis has evolved 5 years on into a sustained and transformative civil war. Today, Myanmar's map is fundamentally rewritten. The military junta, once dominant nationwide, now struggles to maintain effective control across much of the country. The state itself shows signs of institutional decay, seeking legitimacy through tightly controlled elections while relying on forced conscription to offset mounting manpower shortfalls. Large portions of the population have been displaced. Governance has fractured, and positions once considered secure have fallen to a resistance that is no longer simply a protest movement, but a complex coalition of ethnic armed organizations and local defense forces. As the junta loses ground, the regional stakes rise. From illicit scam center economies to shifting border dynamics involving China and Thailand, Myanmar has become a persistent source of regional instability with direct implications for Indo-Pacific security. This episode is not about daily battlefield updates, and it's not about humanitarian advocacy. It's about understanding what 5 years of sustained internal war do to a state, and how power legitimacy and governance are contested, not only on the battlefield, but in the cognitive domain shaping Southeast Asia's future. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 54 of Dialogue, Civil War, Myanmar 5 years on, a conversation with Dr. Mimi Nguyen Bird. Dr. Bird has tracked Myanmar's conflict since the earliest days of the coup. Today we take stock of how the battlefield and political dynamics have changed, what paths remain open or closed, and what this five-year war means for Indo-Pacific security. Mimi Nguyen Bird, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. I always enjoy sitting down with you on an annual basis now.
This is our third sit-down to talk about what is, without a doubt, a humanitarian plight, a crisis, and a significant security challenge here in the region.
Yeah, and I would say it's beyond, you know, the humanitarian crisis. This has become a source of instability in this part of the world in the Indo-Pacific region.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. I have turned to you over and over and over to better understand what's going on here. We sat down in the last 2 years, this is our third year in a row now sitting down to talk about this. You wrote a wonderful book chapter in the book, Edge of Competition. Yours was Edge of Conflict, I think, Myanmar Edge of Conflict. And so I've continually come to you to better understand what's going on. And today we are going to, you know, pull on your experience of this, your close connections. We're going to ask you to think about some of these things, maybe in a little different light than we've asked in some of the other episodes. We're grateful for our viewers. We've had a number of them who have reached out in advance of the program talking about this show. And so, thank you, Mimi.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, today is the Lunar New Year. So we must say to everybody, you know, a happy Lunar New Year, and you know, wishing everybody happiness and health and
yeah,
peace.
I wholly agree with you. And in Korean, you would say that, Sehebok Mani Baruseyo, which is, I wish upon you, you know, the New Year's good luck. And so, good fortunes. And so we do. We'd wish that upon all our guests and you as a close friend of mine, upon you and your family as well.
As well as the Myanmar people.
And the Myanmar people who need so much.
Yes.
Thank you for raising that. So let's go. Let me just ask you.
All right.
Let's talk about what kind of war this is. Mm-hmm. 5 years after the coup, Myanmar's conflict has expanded beyond post-coup resistance into a protracted multi-front civil war.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this way. What kind of war is Myanmar fighting 5 years on?
Okay. Many will refer to Myanmar conflict or the opposition as the rebels or rebellions, but it has gone beyond rebellion. I think that using that word doesn't properly describe what's happening. It's a revolutionary war. Yes. So rebellion is just changing, a limited change. For example, regime change. That would be a rebellion. But this is a systematic change that people are trying to do. And that is more of a revolution, a new system, right? They're going beyond restore democracy to building federal democracy, right? Where each of the federal states, you know, federal units, will have their level of autonomy similar to that of United States. Mm. How we will have the state rights, and then you have the all come together into a federated central government. So it's a totally different system for Myanmar.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, and so. When I think about, I like the way you've framed this. And so when I think of a rebellion, I think about we are trying to change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like the way this is happening, and we rise up or a group rises up and they try to force you to bring about changes. And maybe there was some of that earlier on. In a revolution, you're like you just described, we are bringing about a whole different system. And so because of that difference, one, you might be able to compromise in a rebellion. There's more compromising going on, but your core requirements, the aspirations that you're seeking in a revolution doesn't lend itself to a whole lot of compromise. And so the duration maybe is longer, and revolutions often can go very protracted, long time in the fight. What are you thinking?
Yeah. Well, I would say that this conflict has been going on for a long time, especially if you're ethnic minority groups, right? So it's a continuation. But in this 5 years, what has changed is the majority Burmans are now, you know, along with it, they now believe that federal democracy is the only system that will bring a sustainable peace to the people. In the past, prior to the coup, the Burmans think of federal democracy as a dirty word, or it is just being separatist. But at this moment in time, there is no doubt an overwhelming majority believe that federal democracy is the only system that is, you know, doable for Myanmar.
Hmm. Well, let's pull on that more, and let's pull on this in different ways. I want to talk about the battlefield balance. And so, you know, I first interviewed you 3 years ago into the conflict. The resistance was still consolidating. At 4 years, just last year, we saw a significant territorial shift. How would you characterize the battlefield balance today? I mean, 5 years in, where does each side retain a decisive advantage?
Mm-hmm. So, as of now, the military junta control only 30% of the territory. So it has become just one of the armed groups within this conflict, right? And then 40%, controlled by the coalition of the revolutionary forces. And then the remaining 30% is being contested.
Wow.
So as you can say, the military junta control has significantly eroded Right.
And so they're mostly in the metropolitan,
in the large population areas. But also on the Revolutionary Coalition side, it also demonstrated they can take territory and hold on to them. Seize territory and hold on to them. They have been able to demonstrate that. And right now, last over 2 years, a little in the margin, they will have lose this town, lose this base, gain it back. But overall, the 30%, the remaining 40%, I don't think the military junta will be able to get it back.
That makes it challenging, right? I mean, when you think about the type of conflicts going on, the way you've just described this loss of land, it almost makes the junta feel like they're desperate in trying to retain some bit of legitimacy. Let's talk a little bit then about regime survival versus state control. So the junta has remained in power, but its effective control and governance capacity appear uneven across the country, as you just described. So when you think about what does this mean for regime survival while the state itself is weakened? Are they more worried about regime survival than they, go ahead.
Yes. They are at the survival mode, just to survive, regime survival. The state control is absolutely gone because especially all the border areas, right? They don't control most of the border areas anymore. So all the border traits are under the control of the local armed resistance revolutionary organizations. So so state control is no longer it's on its heel just trying to survive and holding it together. And that's where right after, I think, Operation 1027, I saw some writing in from China saying they thought that military junta would collapse within 3 to 4 months. And that's why they put in their support behind it. They don't trust the military regime, military junta, but they don't want it collapse either, because they want that fracture state to gain control over that. Okay. So, but anyways, at that point, a military regime is at a survival mode, and it had to go. It couldn't have survived without that increased aggressive meddling or support from China.
Wow. So let's talk a bit about the Tatmadaw, the military. Right, they're under strain, and so. And, nearly 2 years after the war began, they were about 2 years ago, they were forced conscription. I remember you talking about that when we were here and how they were, that AWOL and desertion was just at records that they couldn't sustain.
Mm-hmm.
The Tatmadaw faced sustained pressure on cohesion, professionalism, force generation. So how resilient is the Tatmadaw as an institution at this stage of the conflict?
If you think resiliency is based on its legitimacy,
okay,
right, and its cohesiveness and its ability to command,
yeah,
right, command, all of in those area is eroding, right? The legitimacy lacks legitimacy in the eyes of the people as well as the eyes of the international community. But even within the organization, it is starting to erode because its involvement in a lot of criminal activity is no longer a professional military organization. It acts and behaves like criminal gangs or cartel.
Is that to be able to fund the organization, the battalions, the companies, or is that to line their own pockets, or maybe both?
Both. Yeah, most of it, they are getting involved to line their pockets, and it starts from the from the highest to the lowest, and then in order for them to operate, right, keep on funding their war machine. Also, their economy has collapsed, right? Economy at best is half of what it was back in a pre-coup, and a lot of capital flight, a lot of businesses left, and the currency has collapsed. So all that stuff, go into, it's desperate to keep this war machine going,
yeah,
and it increased reliance on the criminal activity like drug trafficking, you know, scam center. Scam center has been big in the recent years, yeah.
And so, you know, when I think about having a little bit of experience, you know, in this area where corrupt militaries cause difficulty in cohesive units, I've seen this firsthand in places I've been. And so it would be very difficult if you're a soldier in a unit to be able to feel connected to the purpose and to the camaraderie and to the lack of values that are there if in fact it is not about that. It's merely about extracting and taking through corruption and through graft, or as you were just going into, scam centers, and yeah. Maybe you might even talk more about that.
Yeah, well, a scam center, but also that each individual soldiers don't feel like they're being cared for, right? They don't have their back. Their leaders don't have their back,
yeah.
Right? So that you create this very low morale. And then on top of that, the soldiers know that the population don't support them. Right, the people don't support them, as well as many of the newer soldiers that are coming in, were force conscripted. Yeah. They were abducted, you know, and they are ransomed in some cases. Right, so they may have the numbers, but the quality of soldier isn't there, and that's why on the ground is a lot of losses on the military junta side. The military junta only has the air power and firepower at its advantage. But on the coalition of revolutionary forces side, they have people support, and they have that larger than life. You know, they have this goal of establishing federal democratic system. So there's a lot higher morale on the side of the revolutionary forces and the military junta side. And you can see that from a lot of defections and a lot of desertion and just battle losses in the front line, given that the firepower just differential is so high.
You know, when listening to the way you describe that, it makes you wonder how they're able to be so, I don't want to say successful after 5 years, but still holding on, or still the military, the Tatmadaw, how they are still putting in the field forces that are able to fight the resistance forces. And I guess we'll pull on that more when we talk about the future, but it is one side has purpose and the other side is you know, they got to, with guns, keep the people in line to keep them from deserting. It seems like two different fights going on internally.
So in the Revolutionary Forces side, yeah. One weakness is they have not put focus and strategy toward, coherent strategy to drive even more defections. They have not focused on that. They've been focusing so much on the tactical, the military, the battles, rather than focusing and, using that weakness. The psychological, the morale weakness. So they have not focused on that issue. And so the current defection is just naturally occurring. It's not based on the really coherent strategy.
Hmm. So I want to pull on some things you've said. So let's talk a little bit about the resistance cohesion. And so the resistance forces have become more capable. You described that. And yet external observers, they still fear fragmentation as what could be an outcome from this war. And so how cohesive is the resistance politically, and do you see inter-ethnic cooperation that suggests this viable federal democracy framework that you've mentioned a couple of times now?
Yeah.
How do you see that?
Yeah, the cohesion on the revolutionary side, I want to say revolutionary because it's resistance, right?
Fair enough, revolutionary.
It's gone beyond the resistance, so that's why I keep on the word revolutionary forces. The cohesiveness is a bit uneven. Some areas, some regional, sub-region area are more cohesive than others. But they're all advancing. That is an unprecedented level of cooperation. But they need to get to so they have sub-regional level cooperation. They have sub-regional level joint commands and strategy. But they need to come up with their overall joint strategy at the national level. They all have the common goal. Common goal. They are very clear about that. But the ways and means, they need that joint strategy on ways and means. And means meaning like sharing the really good a way to sharing resources,
yeah.
Right? Sharing resources, somebody having to forego something to, you know.
This is unity of command and unity of purpose and effort.
Yes.
And what you're saying is it's lacking. It is an area they need to do more in?
Yeah, they need to do more. They are going toward it, but they're not there yet. So that's what's something that, you know, when we talk about later on where we're going, and that will be something we'll be paying a lot of attention to. Can they come up with this beyond their sub-regional level into a across the nation joint command, joint strategy with resources, you know, sharing resources, agreements.
You know, talking, you've mentioned about revolution a couple times now. So when I think about revolutions, revolutionary wars, I also think about, in the beginning, the masses rise up, which we've seen, and later the leader comes forward. And so what I'm hearing you describe a little bit is this unified leadership that is pulling everybody together in the same direction is perhaps still not there.
Yeah, there has not been national level leader that people believe and, you know, accept like Aung San Suu Kyi was, right? But at the sub-regional level, you have a Rakhine, you know, ethnic leader that emerging. You have a Kachin, you have Karen, you know, Karenni. So they have sub-regional level leader that are emerging, but we have not seen that one leader, you know, that can pull together at the national level.
Yeah, there are, how many, 19, 20, I mean, there's quite a few groups, right, that have to kind of be pulled together. And so we'll see. Let's talk then about this legitimacy and governance is where I'm kind of taking us. And so you have often emphasized that this war is being fought as much in the minds of its people as it is on the ground.
Yeah.
And so how important is local governance in these so-called liberated zones? And maybe you talk a little bit about that at this stage of the war. I mean, how important is that?
Yeah. So we were talking about earlier fracturing, right?
Yep.
So Myanmar is already fractured, you know, at this point, right? Because military junta can only control 30% of the territory. So the remaining areas are being controlled by various coalition forces. And they are having to provide the basic services and governance in those areas. Right. So when people say like fracturing, like something future, but in fact it already is.
That's fair. So it is fractured. Mm-hmm. It is, and it, how do we unify it? Or but then again, the question I was asking is, how important is this governance then within those different areas, since it's not being provided by the state? And so I'll let you say more.
So as a legitimacy, you asked the question of legitimacy. So military junta does not have the legitimacy, both internally or externally, from international. And that's why they try to present this sham election or fake election, which is interestingly funded by and supported by Chinese Communist Party, right? But it was not free and fair at all, because a lot of the parties that people really believed in, people have trust in, were not allowed to compete because they were dissolved. And then all the leaders were thrown in jail, right? Mm. And then there's all kinds of voter irregularities. They ran the election in three phases, and there have been reports of same people participating each of the phases, like doubling their votes. So the whole also the whole process was opaque. So you know, by all the means, it was not. And as a result, the international community has, you know, resoundingly said it was not a sham election.
Yeah, I mean, this was a predetermined outcome that just needed were seeking a facade of an election for legitimacy, and it was no surprise that the military, you know, came out victorious in the election.
Right.
I mean, so who was surprised about that when you're
right? So it doesn't have legitimacy in that way, but also inside the country, it's not able to provide services, and especially for the, you know, beyond that 30%, and they are seen as a force for predation, destruction, and punishment. Right, not a force that provides security or services.
Right.
So,
but in the local regions, are those institutions providing services as they may be, are they seen as legitimate? Go ahead.
That's, I think, where the opportunity rises for the revolutionary forces, right? If they are able to provide more governance, they provide justice, you know, a predictable justice system and basic services, then they can really gain more legitimacy. They're already legitimate because they are anti-junta,
yeah,
right? But the next step we're looking for, again, is that are they going to be able to provide these basic governance and services, and in spite, but also, you know, in the under fire, because anytime they build school, they build hospital, then military junta will come and bomb it. So that is a they're having to build governance under fire, and but also there is a level of coordination and cooperation across everybody. It's just that you just haven't seen the more cohesive one entity, but that doesn't mean that there's no cooperation happening. There are cooperation happening between the NUG, National Unity Government entities, and the ethnic, you know, revolutionary organization. All of them are talking and cooperating, but it's just that we haven't seen more of a cohesive at the one entity in the national level.
You know, when I think about revolution, because you have used that word several times now, I think about the Revolutionary War. This year is, of course, the semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary for the United States and its revolution. And when, and you know, you can't actually draw full comparisons, but in those years, the United States Congress was not a central body that was really running the country. That wasn't the case at all. And so it was local areas running their states, right? It was state governance, and they were under conflict, and it was quite challenging. And the war went on for longer than we've been 8 years. Went longer than they've been going on right now. And so in Myanmar, and so and the ability to bring together this legitimacy and unity and even a federal state. You know, we take it for granted now, but it was a difficult thing at the time as they were trying to make it happen.
Yeah, so there's many similarities. And interestingly, you know, Ken Burns just did a documentary on the American Revolution.
Yep.
Revolution. And when I was watching it, if anybody wanted to watch it, it's really a good program. It has a lot of parallels and similarities. You know, the context may be different, but there are, you know, same principle at play in between those two revolutions that I am, you know, studying. Right?
Yeah.
So, yes. So I would say that what's happening in Myanmar today is very much like America's 250 years ago.
Let's go ahead and zoom out. Let's look at ASEAN's limits. So ASEAN's 5-point consensus is a plan to is meant to reduce violence and to open dialogue, right? And so, I mean, this remains the primary diplomatic framework, and yet its practical impact has been limited, right? So what role can ASEAN realistically play now, and where is the outside diplomacy most misaligned in the realities than the realities on the ground?
Yeah. ASEAN is, you know, because of their charter, it is quite limited, but it still is very useful. It still has power to affect the conflict. And the 5-point consensus, everybody say it's dead on arrival, but because of the incompliance of the junta that has signed the 5-point consensus, and it refused to follow and comply with it, and it's able to, withheld, ASEAN can withhold its recognition. And right now, the ASEAN has withheld recognition of this sham election. Until it follows and adhere to the five-point consensus, ASEAN have to keep that diplomatic pressure, right? Because junta right now desperately want that legitimacy. So any type of ASEAN recognition will give a little bit of that legitimacy it wanted. So by denying that, it's, you know, I think it can pressure the junta. But, you know, without any tangible assistant, right, then, you know, it's limited. It's limited. Right? But ASEAN can still use itself as a platform to put, you know, coalition together to put more political pressure on the military junta, and then of course the humanitarian assistance. Right? If ASEAN members, which is neighbor to Myanmar, which is Thailand, can really, if they can open up the humanitarian corridor, that would be very, very helpful to the Myanmar people. But ASEAN still has a role. It may be limited, and it is constrained by its ASEAN way and ASEAN charter, but I think that it's doing what it can at this moment. And it, to a degree, it does have impact.
Okay. Let's talk then a little bit about China and border dynamics. So Myanmar's war is increasingly a border and a regional security issue, especially, I think, along the China-Myanmar frontier, where Beijing's actions, I mean, they can help shape these local incentives. And so how would you characterize China's role along Myanmar's border today?
I would say China's role is not trying to end the war. Mm. It is to manage its instability along its border and then its interest, its corridor, economic corridor.
Why do you think that?
Because it doesn't... It assists both sides. It plays on both sides. Because it doesn't want the military to be too strong, but it doesn't want it to collapse. And then it also support the you know, some of the ethnic armed organization that is along its border. So for China, when Myanmar is fractured and weak, it's placed into its hand. And it really wants, it doesn't want military to collapse because it's so corrupt. And corruption is very good for China. Yeah, they utilize the corruption as their business model to do to control and to control and exploit and get what they want.
So, what do you think they're getting out of Myanmar, China? What's China getting out of Myanmar? And whether it's in the peripheral areas, the regional areas along its border, or even out of the junta, are there things that you think it's being able to extract out of that relationship?
What do you think? Yeah, well, it's getting a lot of concession. So the biggest concession has been having boots on the ground, right? In the past, it's against the Myanmar military junta's constitution to have any foreign boots on the ground. But now they are allowing these private security companies,
right,
in like Zhaopiu Port.
Okay.
And conduct, and they have like some forces that are coming in to monitor the ceasefire agreement between things. So, and these are the things that would not have been possible, but now the military junta is so weakened and so desperate that they are allowing. So they are getting a lot of concession. Even this week, the number two, junta's number two, said that they will make sure China, the Myanmar, is the back door to the Indian Ocean.
You've been saying that for years, haven't
you? Yes, I know, right? So now he said he's going to open the back door to
You've been worried about this being the reality, and
yes,
now you're saying they're going to do the thing you've been warning about.
And they're going to open that door, he says, and that was not possible before. So they're getting, China is getting a lot of concession. And for China, Myanmar, if I've said it over and over, is a vital strategic interest because of that. Because it's opened the back door to the Indian Ocean. It resolved the vulnerability of Malacca dilemma. And it's also has rich with critical minerals, right? So for those reasons, Myanmar is a very a vital interest geopolitically, more than economics.
To China,
yeah.
I want to pull on a lot of threads we've talked about as we think about the end state you can foresee where this might go, and maybe even some of the early signals. And so 5 years into the war and a return to the pre-coup status just doesn't, I mean, it seems unlikely. We're just going to zap ourselves back to where this was. And so if that's not the case, the key question perhaps is what end states are now realistic? Is it, I'll let you fill some of those things in there. And then what signals would tell us that we're along this trajectory that is shifting? And so does it look like we're talking about a stalemate or a fragmentation or a negotiated transition or something else? What's the future? Tell us the future.
I don't know if I can tell the future, but we can say what is a possible trend, right? Possible.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on a road trip, you can tell you're getting close to something because you see all these road signs.
Yes.
What are the signs telling us?
Right. But the one thing that for sure it's not going to happen is going back to pre-coup status, right? Because pre-coup status would be, like I said, rebellion. It's just restoring democracy, which was centralized, whereas they're going toward this federal democracy. So it's a different system. But what we can see is that it's a protracted conflict, because of the external, as I said, the military is on its heel, but the only reason it's been able to stay is in this zombie status is because of a lot of aggressive assistance from China and to a degree also Russia. Russia, they're getting. Whereas, meanwhile, on the resistance side, there is a do-it-yourself DIY revolution because there's no state sponsor
assistance
coming from anywhere. So, but what we're looking at is the revolution side that unity of effort, right? The trend toward unity of effort. Are they able to develop this joint strategy and joint command? Right? And then sharing some type of agreement on sharing resources. So that would be the key thing that we need to watch for. And then on the military, that's more of a little bit military political, but on the military side, are they able to really disrupt their production and the airfield? Right, airfields, and because that's what their firepower. Like I said, the military main advantage is right now firepower and air power. So if they're able to get to that, right? So then firepower meaning like production facilities, and air bases, right? If they're able to disrupt those, and that will be also it will go to a trajectory of the end state that the revolutionary forces want. So there's a stalemate in that, I would argue, yeah.
So we can go one of two ways, perhaps. Is that, well.
But military getting all back is not an option, I don't
think. Yeah, I mean, I can see that. So again, before the coup, strong central government that was dictating to the degree it was to the region, and the regional states are like, no, we're going to have more say. We're going to push for a federated state, and we're going to move in that direction. I got that, and I also understand. They don't have a whole lot of external assistance to make this, so they're really DIY doing it themselves. And China is happy for to muddle this along so that they don't move in a direction which is contrary to their interests as well.
Right, that's why some people are suggesting that to pull the Myanmar out of China influence is to engage with the junta. Hmm. Engage with the junta. And I think that's the misunderstanding of what's happening. if it was military junta was having the control of this, still have control of the entire territory, okay, that may be the a good way to go. But as I said, they only have 30%, yeah. And they have completely lost legitimacy, and people don't accept them. You know, they have so. I don't think betting on military junta will get there. In fact, engaging with military junta will increase in legitimacy, and it will play right into China's hand, because military junta will never be uncorrupted, because the corruption is so endemic. No amount of legitimate engagement will change that. It will always play into China's hand, because that is China's MO, is utilizing that endemic corruption to get what it wants. So I would argue that is not when people say that, I know they don't really quite understand what actually happening on the ground. And it would be better to counter, the best counter to China is for Myanmar to become a federal democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, you're saying they're too far gone just to restore or revitalize what they've got. They need something brand new there, and they're fighting for that.
Yeah.
Got a lot of audience questions, and so maybe we'll go through a few of these in our time remaining. And so this question is asking about China's objectives. So what is China's ultimately trying to protect or to achieve in Myanmar at this stage of the war? So I know you've talked a bit about this, but maybe you might pull on some things you haven't talked about.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a vital interest, like solving. I think geopolitical interest is higher priority than economic. If the economic is the priority, they will want stability. Right, you can't do business if you know the country in fracture state or at war, right? But I think for them, the key thing is geopolitical. Like I said, backdoor to Indian Ocean, the Malacca dilemma, vulnerability, and also controlling. If they control Myanmar, they can control West entrance of the Malacca Strait. And so that will flip the vulnerability to their advantage, right? Because Malacca Strait is the, you know, a third of their world trade goes through, and 80% of the energy supplies for Northeast Asia has to go through Malacca Strait. So that's why I'm of a, you know, opinion that the geopolitical is more important. So they will try to control it any way they can. And they understand military junta is too weak to gain all of them back. You know, they understand that too. So they're, you know, playing both sides and keeping it fractured and then manipulate it so that they can exploit the situation to their advantage.
So this next question is asking about China's leverage. So how much real leverage does Beijing have over the junta and key border actors, and what are the limits of that leverage?
They have a limit. And no amount of China will stop this revolution. I think that short term, they will gain that leverage, but in the long term, the people will not forgive China. I mean, China really had an opportunity to be the friend to the people. You know, if they have come in and helped the people with their desire, they will forever be, you know, great friends to them. But they didn't do it that way. You know, and one other thing is China is all about elite capture rather than really understanding the people. So I think they misunderstood the people. They understand the elite, but they don't understand the people. So I think in a way, that's a miscalculation on their part. So they will have a short-term win, but they will have a long-term loss.
So in our analogy we used about the American Revolution, they are not the French. China is not the French in this, where they're assisting the people to overthrow the government. And so when this is all done and over, your point is, they'll remember that, and China will not be seen in favorable light.
Right. So. Right now, the anti-China sentiment is through the roof in Myanmar population.
Okay. This next question is asking a little bit more on the elections and legitimacy. And so how should we interpret the junta's recent electoral efforts? Maybe say more about that. And what responses have mattered internationally?
It is a scam election, a sham election, fake election, whatever you want to call it, but it is not free and fair. Everybody has declared that and anybody that looked at it has been anything but that. So it's not really get their legitimacy that they want it, they need it. The biggest thing is the people rejection of that. And some of the people, especially in their control area, 30%, actually they're able to run the polling in like a 20% of the country. So really the result, even if the result was free and fair, then it still doesn't represent the entire country because they couldn't run the election, right? And then the people rejected, and people went to the polling station because they were at gunpoint. Hmm. Right, they were coerced and they pressured and threatened to go to the polling station. But the biggest thing was at the outset in December, they had a silent strike again, another countrywide silent strike where the whole country went silent. Because if they can't come out to the street, right? If they come out to the street, they'll be shot. But the military junta can't do anything if they're just staying at home. So everybody again participated in it, and that's that silent is the loudest voice of Myanmar people rejecting the military and the election. So without the people's support, really it doesn't have the legitimacy, and then the external international community can't legitimize it either. I mean, of course, China and Russia will try to push it within their sphere of influence and try to get the Myanmar election to be recognized, but it will be a small portion. Another thing with Myanmar is Myanmar junta does not have UN representation. The representative, UN representative that is sitting in New York is representing the people, not the junta. So really, they're being suspended from ASEAN. So overall, they are in illegitimate.
Yeah, they don't have any representation internationally. But I understand this, but I'm not so sure all of the audience does. And so the National Unity Government that formed out of the government which, the party which won office in, 2020 was it?
Yeah, 2020,
the 2020
yes.
Election.
Yeah.
So go ahead and explain this a little bit more about that group and then their representation in the United Nations and what you're getting at,
More on that. National Unity Government was formed by...
The National League for Democracy, right?
A lot of the people, the member of the parliament that were elected, but they escaped capture of the military junta. So they formed together this National Unity Government. But because the election in 2020 was overwhelmingly NLD, National League for Democracy, they did bring in, representative from other ethnic minority group into the, so NUG, National Unity Government, the president, acting president is a Kachin. He's not a Burman or Burma, right? So, they have, various ministers that are, they're ethnic from the ethnic minority group. So it is put together, and then they have a good relationship with the ambassador that is in UN, Ambassador Zhou Mutu there. So, and they have constant relationship, and then Ambassador Zhou Mutu continue to present, the junta atrocities at the UN. So he is the representative. He can vote as well, and he votes more with the National Unity Government position than the junta's.
That's interesting. Thanks for sharing with that. So this next question is asking about economic ties with ASEAN. And so are Myanmar's economic ties with ASEAN members functioning more as a stabilizer, an enabler, or simply channels for risks? How do you see this these ties, these economic ties?
Yes. That right now, Myanmar economy is primarily dominated by the cronies, the military junta and the cronies. So by doing business, you just creating income for them, which they turn around and use the revenue and income from those trade to buy more bombs and drones and bombs. So I think that, you know, I mean, people need economic activities, but dealing directly with the junta just fill up their coffers, right? But the border areas, right, like I said, the border trades are all pretty primarily controlled by the revolutionary forces. So allowing that border trade, and in many ways, Thailand is having to deal with the, you know, the bordering ethnic resistance organization or revolutionary organization. And so same thing with India. India may be, the Delhi may be dealing with the junta, but the bordering state having to deal with the whatever the group that is in charge of that territory. So you know, allowing those economic corridor through the borders will be very, very helpful because people still need to, you know, trade and do commerce. Yeah.
This next question is asking about regional security partnership. And so which spillover effects are shaping neighboring countries' security choices most strongly right now? Are they talking about borders, crime, refugees, or something else?
Yeah. Myanmar, you know, has become the exporter of instability and crime right now. And the thing is, junta is very much involved with that. Especially this latest thing has been the scam center, proliferation of scam center in the Thai-Burma border and then the China-Burma border. And they just did the really good analysis, and it all traced back to the junta. They could not have expanded that level without junta's involvement. But also, there's an indirectly, there was the forced conscription. Forced conscription law effort by the junta has pushed all the young people to the border areas. There are hundreds and thousands of young people trying to escape this forced conscription. But then the nefarious, the scam center recruited them and said they come and do they give him marketing jobs. So then suddenly these all scam center has like huge influx of labor, which they're able to utilize to, you know, and make more calls and reach out and touch their victims, more victims, right? So that's why 24 and 25, the spike, right, the exponential spike in the scam center operation is due to this increase in labor.
Yeah.
Sudden, you know.
And these are multi-billion dollar profit generating scams that are going on regionally, but globally as well. I mean, the United States put forth some legislation against these scam centers.
Right.
As well.
In 2024 in the United States, 10 billion dollars loss.
Yeah.
And the average scam, you know, per person that was lost, $155,000. But even within my personal social circle, one person lost $1.8 million.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And these are very sophisticated scam center, scam operation. So, and the interesting thing is they are tied to, of course, the Chinese criminal enterprises. You know, every time I interview some of the lower worker, they always say the managers and above are all Chinese. The lower level may be Burmese or other ethnic, but then managers above are Chinese. And then many of these scam centers started out as BRI investments, Belt and Road Initiative, you know, CCP back investment, and then they turn into illegal gambling center, and then turn into these scam centers that we see today.
Hmm. Let's ask one more question as we close, and this one's asking about access. So has humanitarian and international access meaningfully changed over the past year and how does access or the denial of access, I mean, how does this affect the conflict strategic environment?
Well, because of the, you know, the lack of international support for humanitarian assistance, the revolutionary forces has to, you know, shift many of their main effort toward taking care of the people.
Yeah, Myanmar, didn't they have a massive earthquake in 2024?
Yes, and military junta was able to, not 2024, I think 2025.
Was it last year, 2025?
Yeah, 2025. Yeah. And they were able to weaponize
that. It was March of 25, yeah. That's
yes,
right.
Yes. They are able to use it to further their survival. Out of that, you know, there's suddenly influx of a lot of international aid, and they're coming through the junta. And next thing you know, junta boss was able to buy himself a private plane.
Wow.
You know? So the people that really need it didn't get it.
Yeah.
Didn't get it, yeah.
Yeah. Amy, I've really appreciated this this hour together, and so thank you for coming in and to help us understand a little bit better about the real complexity of the situation.
Yes, thank you for having me. Yeah. I always enjoy sitting down with you.
Yeah, and before I let you go, though, I like to solicit a book recommendation, and so what would you suggest our audience listen to?
Oh, yes, yeah. There's another one, Sean Turnell. He has written another book called Best Laid Plans. Inside story of reform in Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar. So because he was her economic advisor inside, so he has an inside seat into what was happening. So I recommend that. And then, I think he's a good writer, and
wonderful.
He's interesting to read. Yeah.
And so we'll add that to the show notes as well. And so thank you again, Mimi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. As we conclude today's dialogue, this conversation reminds us that civil wars in the Indo-Pacific are rarely brief and never contained. 5 years into Myanmar's conflict, the lesson is not about headlines, it's about endurance and the long-term consequences of sustained internal war. Instability doesn't remain local. It reshapes the strategic landscape far beyond the battlefield. Understanding that reality is essential to effective security policy. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us for this important dialogue. My thanks to Dr. Mimi Nguyen Bird for her insights and analysis. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.